Hello everybody, Julian Charles here of themindrenewed.com, coming to you from the depths of the Lancashire countryside here in the UK. And a little later than anticipated, here is part two of our latest interview with Dr. Tim Ball, who, as most of you will surely know, is a retired, well, retired in inverted commas, lecturer who taught geography and historical climatology at the University of Winnipeg for many, many years, and who I'm very pleased to say is quite a regular guest at TMR. I was unable to post the full interview last time, but here, as promised, is the rest of it. Last time, we talked about issues surrounding the lawsuit brought against Dr. Ball by the climatologist Dr. Michael Mann, strategic lawsuits against public participation, otherwise known as SLAPs, which is a very strange acronym, Dr. Ball's experience of having recently been invited to Washington in connection with Trump's transition team on the Environmental Protection Agency, and the political hot potato question of the relationship between big oil and climate skepticism. So, now in this second part, we move on to discuss the, quote, hottest year on record phenomenon, the question of data tampering in climate science. Is it tampered with? Is it not? Well, we'll see. And the recent statement by Dr. John Bates that significant research challenging the roughly 20-year pause in global warming was, in his opinion, flawed. So we pick up the conversation from where we left off last time. So, of course, what we have to establish here is whether this hottest year on record is true or fake, because we've been getting this time and time again, particularly over the last 3 years. So just to kick this off, I've got three quotes here. We've got the BBC from the beginning of, well, 16th of January 2015. Quote, 2014, warmest year on record, say US researchers. Flip to the next year, The Guardian, 20th of January 2016. Quote, 2015 smashes record for hottest year, final figures confirmed. Experts warn that global warming is tipping climate into uncharted territory as Met Office, NASA and NOAA data all confirm record global temperatures for second year running. Then flip to the next year, so this is the beginning of this year, 18th of January. This is a priceless one. Quote, 2016, hottest year ever recorded and scientists say human activity to blame. Final data confirms record-breaking temperatures for third year in a row. Earth has not been this warm for 115,000 years. Mm. So that's pretty formidable stuff. It's getting warmer all the time. The UK Met Office, NASA, NOAA, they're all saying this. Well, it's QED, isn't it, Tim?
Well, NASA and NOAA are the two saying it. But actually, there are five official global temperature measurements. The hottest year ever data was coming from NASA GISS, which is the Goddard Institute of Space Studies. And it was doctored data, created data. And Tony Heller, as I said, has shown how they did it. The person behind it is a Gavin Schmidt. And Gavin Schmidt was a graduate of the climatic research unit at the University of East Anglia. He was a protege of Tom Wigley at that institute. And in fact, that institute produced so many of the people that were involved. We see it through the leaked emails. But Schmidt was hired at NASA GISS and replaced James Hansen. Now, Hansen was the guy who was plucked out of obscurity by Senator Timothy Wirth and by Senator Al Gore to appear before them in 1988 in a hearing at which he said he's 99% certain that humans are causing global warming. There was no evidence for that whatsoever. And to give you an idea of the level of corruption that's gone on from the very beginning with this, and I'll get around to explaining how they claim the warmest year ever. But people can read about this. Senator Wirth talks about it in a Frontline interview on PBS. It's available on the internet. And all they have to Google is Frontline Senator Wirth and Hansen, and it'll pop right up. And what they did was, he said, we needed somebody that would come out and say that humans were causing global warming. And they found Hansen, and he agreed to appear before the committee. They staged it to this extent. They went and found out what was the hottest day of the year on average in Washington, D.C. They scheduled the hearing for that day. They then went in the night before, opened all the windows, and shut off the air conditioning. So here was a meeting about global warming held in a swelteringly hot committee room. And this is the level of staging that went on right from the start. And Hansen, of course, was involved in so much of the corruption of the data through NASA GIS. And in fact, he was actually arrested outside of the White House for protesting against coal burning plants as a civil servant. That is in contradiction to the Hatch Act, which was a law passed to say that civil servants cannot be active politically. They can have their own political agenda, but they cannot be politically active themselves. And I asked Hansen's boss, a fellow by the name of John Toon, I said, how did he get away with it? And he said, we were told from above not to touch him, to leave him alone. And I said, what do you mean by above? He said, almost as far as you can go. In other words, he named Al Gore without naming Al Gore. It got so bad that 50 NASA astronauts and scientists signed a petition saying that we want this corruption of climate science shut down because it's giving NASA a very, very bad name. And I knew that was coming because I was invited to a breakfast by Harrison Schmitt, who was the last astronaut to leave the moon. And he had brought a group of people to a climate conference who had not heard what was going on and said, tell them what's happening here. They could not believe it. Now, Schmitt, of course, was hired when Hansen retired at 75, which was way past normal retirement age. Gavin Schmitt was brought in, and he was the one that was saying, oh, it's the hottest year ever. Now, in that one particular year of 2016, he said it. But of the five global temperature records, his was the only one that was claiming it was the hottest year ever. Well, how much was it hotter than any previous year? 0.012 degrees Celsius. And that is so well within the margin of error of their data. So there's no way that he can make that claim scientifically. But he did it anyway because they want the headline. So this is what's been going on, putting out these things.
You say that NASA GIS has actually been massaging the raw data, is that right?
Yes.
Well, when you go to their Q&A page, they specifically deny that. I mean, the question is, I want to say something about the way in which they deny it, which is interesting, looking at it with a sort of lawyerly hat on, you know, which one can pretend that. Question, do the raw data ever change? Answer, the raw data always stays the same. Except for occasional reported corrections or replacements of preliminary data from one source by reports obtained later from a more trusted source. I mean, looking at it, as I say, with a kind of lawyerly hat on, you think, well, that pretty much means they can change it as they will, doesn't it?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. You're learning to read bureaucratic gobbledygook. No, I mean, it's just laughable. But here's the other thing. It depends on which stations you choose as to the result that you get. And so when I said there's five different agencies and they're all getting data from different sources and they're all coming up with different results, this is what Phil Jones did. You know, the blade on the hockey stick where the temperature suddenly goes up in the 20th century, that was produced by Phil Jones, who was director at CRU, the Climatic Research Unit. And he said the temperature rose 0.6 degrees Celsius in about 120 years. And that is more than it could have gone up naturally. That's rubbish. There's many places where it goes up that fast naturally. But not only that, he published it, but people ignored it. It was 0.6 degrees Celsius plus or minus 0.2 degrees Celsius. In other words, the error on his number was plus or minus 33%. There's no way that you would ever use data like that, even for a public opinion poll. I mean, if they're more than 4% error, they won't use them. And yet here he's using data that's plus or minus 33%. And guess what happened? When Warwick Hughes, an Australian climatologist, wrote to Phil Jones, and we've got the emails, Warwick's put it out there, and he said, Mr. Jones, would you send me your data that you used to produce that blade of the hockey stick? And Jones wrote back and said, no, I won't send you the data because all you want to do is to try and find something wrong with it.
That's a lovely quote. I remember that.
Right,
one,
remember yeah. that one?
Indeed, exactly the opposite of the scientific spirit. Indeed.
Oh, of course.
I mean, this whole business of data, I mean, it's such a loaded word, isn't it? As soon as you have the word data, it sort of implies truth. It's almost like a synonym for truth in many people's minds, I'm quite sure. And yet, of course, it depends what data you're talking about. I mean, one set of data may not cohabit very well with another set of data, etc. And I was looking at whatsupwiththat.com with respect to this latest, being the hottest year on record and all that.
Yeah.
And Anthony Watts got a very interesting bit here where he's saying that the record heat for this last year, he says, is coming from interpolation of data in the Arctic. And then let me quote from him. But in reality, there's just not much data at the poles. There are no permanent thermometers at the North Pole since sea ice drifts, is unstable, melts in the summer, and as it has done for millennia. Weather stations can't be permanent in the Arctic Ocean. So the data is often interpolated from the nearest land-based thermometers.
Yep.
Is what he's saying right there? So it looks like, you know, it's data that's coming from the Arctic where there's virtually no information and it has to be inferred from somewhere nearby.
And my research, of course, was on the Hudson Bay Company and Antarctic climate and temperature. And that information that Anthony's quoting you there came from my section of a book by Anthony and Joe DeLeo on global temperatures. And one of the things that Anthony could have mentioned is that when they reduced the number of stations that they were using to determine the global monthly temperature, in the Canadian Arctic, they chose only one station, a land-based station, and that happens to be an anomaly. It's the warmest station in the Arctic because of a very warm upwelling of water offshore. It's a station called Eureka. So it consistently shows the Arctic warmer than the surrounding area. And by the way, we only have data for about 15% of the world's surface, that is surface data. And the satellite data, for me, is slightly better. It gives more coverage. But again, they have no data for the Antarctic or the Arctic. There's a hole in their satellite data at both those regions. So even their data is questionable. Okay? So what they're doing is they create what they call parameterization. That is, they estimate the temperature over vast amounts of the Earth's surface. And they decided, and they actually use this in their IPCC reports and their data estimates, that if you've got a station, temperature data, that represents the weather and temperature data for 1,200 kilometer radius around the station. Now, you draw a ring around London of 1,200 kilometers and see how much that takes in, and then say that, therefore, London represents that whole area? That's what they're doing.
You just hope also that the station is not fairly near to a boiler house or something.
Well, and usually they are. Yeah, it'll be in Trafalgar Square next to somebody smoking pot or something. But they are that bad. But here's the other thing that they're doing. It's not just with the temperature data. Let's say they've got no soil moisture for a particular region. They'll create a computer model which will then produce data saying, oh, well, the soil moisture for this region is. They call that synthetic data. They will then use that synthetic data as real data in another computer model.
Presumably, there must be some kind of empirical basis to that data?
No.
None whatsoever?
No,
there's nothing to guide the estimation of that data?
No. That's why when we got up before the Australian Senate, Senator Malcolm Roberts and Tony Heller and I, and we said to the CSIRO and the Bureau of Meteorology, the bureaucratic agencies that handle global temperature and global warming for Australia, and we said to them, show us your empirical data. And they couldn't. Mm-hmm. And who were they citing as their sources? NASA GIS, NOAA. I mean, it's just unbelievable. But here's the important thing about this. Malcolm Roberts called me about 6 years ago. He's an engineer. He'd retired. He'd been looking at banking and the whole corrupted banking system. And then he got into the climate issue. Couldn't believe what he was reading. So he called me And I get calls like this all the time from people that finally start to look at what these people are saying, can't believe what they're seeing, and think, am I crazy? I need to verify this with somebody. So I get these calls all the time. It's why I helped set up a group called Friends of Science in Alberta, and why I talk with Malcolm, and we set up a group called the Galileo Movement in Australia. And it was to educate the public about what was going on. Now, Malcolm finally realized that there was no way to challenge the bureaucrats. And Murray Strong knew this when he set up the IPCC. He did it through the World Meteorological Organization, which is comprised of bureaucrats of every national weather office from around the world. And the only people that can challenge bureaucrats are politicians. The rules are that no public citizen can go and challenge a bureaucrat. You have to do it through a politician. So they protect themselves that way. So Malcolm said, okay, fine. I'm going to run for the Senate in Australia, in the state of Queensland. And he got elected. And his maiden speech in the House, and you can go and watch it on YouTube, Senator Malcolm Roberts' maiden speech, he said, okay, you bureaucrats, produce for me a report on the empirical data. You go and read the report. My comment publicly in Australia was, I'd call it sophomoric, but that's an insult to sophomores. And that's, by the way, why Myron Ebell called us in Australia and said, hey, you guys got to come to Washington and talk about this. This was the first time anybody actually challenged what was going on in the bureaucracies. And, of course, why Trump is so eager to take control of the weather office and the bureaucracies. The UK Met Office is now scrambling to save itself and distance itself from NASA, GIS, and all that's going on. But they were so heavily into this, their connection with the Climatic Research Unit, Sir John Houghton, and the whole thing is just an absolute political nightmare.
Well, I wanted to ask you for your reaction to a comment at the end of the article by Anthony Watt. And, of course, this is to do with the accusation that NASA GIS has been massaging the surface station data in a cooling direction so that the current status looks to be hotter than it would otherwise. So let me just read this quote. And I'm not quoting this as saying this has got any authority to it whatsoever, just so that you can react to Are they on the right lines here? I don't know who this person is. They call themselves BW. Anyway, here's the quote. Other people are watching changes in GIS data. Every month, approximately 10% of the entire GIS historical station record are changed. This has been going on since 2008 at least. That is, out of a random sample of 40 stations, about 3 or 4 stations will show a complete revision of historical data, with various amounts over various years. Not all data is changed, and not by large amounts. Some missing data is backfilled, and some old data are deleted. The next month we'll have a different 3 or 4 stations with data that are altered from the previous month. Around December of 2012, there was a much larger revision, with many stations showing many more than the usual adjustments, with some recent year data being lost entirely. About 3 months later, some of the lost data was restored, and some other changes were reversed. Generally, the older data is cooled by some random amount between 0.1 to 1 degree. The remaining stations show no changes in any old data, just the added monthly update. And then they give a whole list of stations that they've consulted for this. So, I mean, the question is that basically right, what they're saying there?
That's exactly right. And, of course, the answer to why are they changing some stations and not others, and the answer is because it's the stations that they use to calculate their final number. You see, that's what I mentioned to you earlier when I talked about Eureka, the station in the Canadian Arctic. They don't take all of the Canadian weather data stations. They just select certain ones. Those are the ones that they use to calculate. See, that was when I talked to you about what Phil Jones did. And Warwick Hughes said to him, well, which stations did you use? How did you adjust them? And Jones said, I'm not going to tell you because you want to find something wrong with it. And guess what happened? When Jones was pushed, because some politicians started to pick up on it and said, hey, what's going on here? And Jones finally had to admit, I've lost the data. Whoa, how convenient. I'm waiting for Michael Mann to come along and say, oh, I've lost the data.
Yes, indeed. Right? Yeah, I can imagine that you are. Yeah.
Yeah. The dog ate my homework.
Is there something of this in Dr. Bates's criticism of that article? Because, I mean, we'll come to this in just a second, but, yeah. You know, he's criticizing the fact that the information is not archived properly.
That's right.
And presumably, if it's not archived properly, it's very difficult for anybody else to check. So let me just ask you about this so-called pause, this hiatus in global warming of about 20 years or so. So, of course, there have been these recent attempts by some to play this down, to remove that pause, if indeed it exists. And so in connection with this, we have, as I'm sure listeners will actually know, we've got this startling recent statement by Dr. John Bates, who before his retirement was in charge of the Climate Data Archive at NOAA. So that's the US National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He was in charge of the Climate Data Archive there. And on the 4th of February, he posted this blog piece, a long blog piece on Dr. Judith Curry's blog, Climate Etc., in which he heavily criticizes an influential academic paper, he claims it's influential anyway, written by his former colleague at NOAA, Dr. Thomas Carl et al. I mean, there are 9 authors in all. So he criticizes this for a number of reasons. Could you tell us about that statement by Dr. Bates, and also whether you think it really is significant? Because it's been quite heavily criticized since, hasn't it?
It's enormously significant. And if Trump needed one reason alone to say we're pulling out of the whole climate program, that incident would be sufficient. Now, one of the things that I and Anthony Watts, who you've referenced earlier, criticized me privately and also a little bit publicly, because I dared to say that they were making Bates out to be a hero and they called him a whistleblower. He wasn't a whistleblower. Whistleblowers are people who reveal information while they're still on the job. Bates waited until he retired before he came out with his comments. Now, he did say that he brought the problem of what Carl et al. Did to his bosses while he was still at work. And you've got to remember that adjustment by Carl was made in 2015. We knew about it. It was known outside of NOAA because at a climate conference in Washington, D.C., Congressman Lamar Smith of Texas, who heads the Congressional Science Committee, appeared before us and said that this claim that the pause did not occur, this paper by Carl, he said, we have subpoenaed all of the documents and all of the information. And so that was in 2015. NOAA refused to disclose the information. They turned down their own or the people's congressional representative. So here's a bureaucrat telling the government of the people to go away. We're not going to give you the data. Now, why didn't Bates at that point go public? And the answer is, of course, because he waited until he retired and he thought he couldn't be attacked. So I've got no great kudos for what Bates has done. Now, why did Carl adjust the pause? Well, the pause began after 1998. 1998 was an exceptionally warm year because of El Nino, and then the temperatures dropped dramatically, and then they started to level off. And initially, people were saying, hey, the temperature's leveling off. And I mentioned earlier in my discussion with you about Huxley's thing about, you know, a hypothesis destroyed by an ugly fact. And I also mentioned to you that by 2003, they weren't acknowledging it publicly, but privately they were changing the name from global warming to climate change.
Yes, yes.
Now, they then came out, and one of the people from the CRU, Benjamin Santer, who's been in this up to his neck right from the beginning, Santer came out and said, well, yeah, it has leveled off, but it's an anomaly, and it's not significant unless it goes on for 17 years. That's where you see those articles about the 17-year watch that went on.
So now we've reached almost 20 years. It should be significant based upon that.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Now, here's the problem. It became significant, but Obama is going to go to the Paris Climate Conference and is basing his whole career and legacy on climate change at the climate conference. The bureaucrats at NOAA, including Tom Carl, knew this. They knew that people at Paris, the skeptics at Paris, who didn't want to take on carbon tax and carbon reductions, were going to say, hey, there's been no increase in temperature. They had to get rid of it. Mm. They had to hide it.
So this is what Dr. Bates means then when he says that this whole thing was rushed to publication before Paris.
Exactly. And by the way...
Yeah, but it has to be said, there's been a comeback on this.
Yep.
And it has been said, this is an Associated Press piece of February the 7th, that, here we go. As far as the study being rushed, the journal says its records show otherwise. Science's new editor-in-chief, Jeremy Berg, said it usually takes 109 days between a paper's submission and its publication. The Carl study, which is what we're talking about, was received by the journal on December the 23rd, 2014, and published 185 days later on June 26th, 2015. So it doesn't look like it was rushed at all, at least this is what they're saying, that it's actually been in the pipeline for a very long time. So is there really any significance to its coming out before the Paris talks?
What is one of the worst things can happen in a pipeline? Mm-hmm. A leak. A leak. The information was leaked. And it doesn't matter what was going on at the academic journal. Yes, there's a long pause between submission of the article. And by the way, 100 days wait for an article to be published is actually amazingly fast. Most of the time, it's 2 or 3 years.
But he says it usually takes 109 days.
That's
what he says, Jeremy Berg, this
nonsense.
New editor. In chief at Science.
Nonsense. In fact, one of the great tragedies, and this is what we need to worry about, is the credibility of Science, because editors like Burke at Science and the editor at Nature, Kennedy, they were in this up to their neck. Go and read the leaked emails where they're communicating directly with these people. Why do you think that the major editors and control of the Journal of Climate were people like Michael Mann, Andrew Weaver, all of the members of the IPCC were editors of that journal because they knew they could get an article published if they had to. They leaked the information, so it didn't matter what was going on with the Journal of Science. That's another red herring. And what did I just tell you? Lamar Smith knew in 2015 what was happening. And he'd already submitted his subpoena by that point. So, no, these are all just diversions away from the fact that they deliberately had to get rid of the pause because Obama. And by the way.
All right. Okay. So
Let me give you one more example.
No. Not this time.
Okay.
Because I don't want to get too far away from the point of this article by Tom Carl and Dr. Bates' criticism of it initially, anyway. So he was saying that not only was there a problem with the way this information was archived, but he says, let me quote, "We find Tom Carl's thumb on the scale, pushing for and often insisting on decisions that maximize warming." That's what he says in this piece, that there's a pushing to maximize warming. Okay, but then he seems to have backtracked from this. So this is going back to the Associated Press piece on February the 7th. It says here, however, Bates, who acknowledges that the Earth is warming from man-made carbon dioxide emissions, said in the interview that there was, quote, "no data tampering, no data changing, nothing malicious. It's really a story of not disclosing what you did. It's not trumped up data in any way, shape, or form." Now, that doesn't seem to quite fit with what was originally written, at least in my view. So it seems to boil down to what he's saying now is that, well, the data wasn't archived, wasn't looked after properly, so it's difficult to get hold of it. But, oh, no, they weren't actually trying to manipulate any of the results.
No. The answer to that is very simple. And, of course, putting the thumb on the scale, you don't leap to the conclusion that that meant that they were adjusting the data. What Carl did was that he selected a temperature record of ocean temperatures that everybody knew was wrong. It was data from temperature taken by buckets out of the ocean, by ocean intakes from ships, and that has been in the literature for 50 years, and we've dealt with that problem of ocean temperatures and reconstruction of early ocean temperatures.
Wouldn't that come under the category of data tampering? And he says there's no data tampering.
No, well, tampering means you actually alter the data.
Right.
You see,
he says there's nothing malicious.
What's malicious? How do you define that? I mean, if you're altering data to get a result in science, that's malicious. That's not what science is about. You go with what the data shows you. You live with what the data shows you.
So, I mean, I'm getting the impression, I can't prove it, that he is backtracked a little bit. He's taken the edge
off his criticism
under pressure.
Of course, because can you imagine the pressure?
Oh, no, I can't. Well,
I can
abstract,
tell you
but only very much in abstract. Yeah.
Oh, and you know, when your pension's threatened, Look at, I mentioned to you about Hansen's boss. I said to him, why did you not come out? I could tell you about Matt F. Kandikar at Environment Canada. He worked there. He knew what was going on. And he waited 5 years after he retired before he started to speak out. And I said, why did you wait so long? He said, because I was afraid they could stop my pension. People have no idea the degree of threat. But tampering, what Carl did was he went back and he found a record that everybody knew you shouldn't use. By the way, that's exactly what Michael Mann did. He picked a tree ring record that everybody said, you don't use it. But he used it because it gave him the hockey stick result that he wanted. That is tampering in the sense of pre-selecting data to produce the result that you wanted. That is so wrong in science. So Carl, yes, it was deliberately orchestrated, and it was done because President Obama needed to speak. And by the way, this has been the history. I wanted to get this point in when you said no.
Sorry.
But this has been that's okay. No.
I have to do that sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. No, that's fine. I understand. Hey, this is what open debate is all about.
Sure.
You know, as somebody once said, we can disagree, but we don't have to be disagreeable. And anyway, this is the history of the IPCC. You see, they release the summary for policymakers, which is completely different from the science report. They release it first because that's what the media pick up on. And they always release it just before the conference of the parties at which the politicians are going to make decisions on how much more funding is needed for climate change research. The big one was COP15 in Copenhagen, and at Copenhagen, they were going to make the decision on how much money and how much political capital was going to be spent on the Kyoto Protocol. That's why the emails were leaked from East Anglia in November of 2009, because they were meeting in Copenhagen in December of 2009.
And importantly, they were leaked. We have no evidence that they were hacked, do we?
No. Well, the Norfolk police were called in by Jones. And by the way, Jones, at the same time he called the police, he also brought in a public relations guy who ended up being the guy that went to jail for the News of the World phone hacking scandal. And what Jones was told was, look, you call the police and tell them that they've been hacked. The reason for that was if they were hacked, the data cannot be used in court. If they were leaked by a whistleblower, the data can be used in court. The problem it created for Jones, of course, was telling the police it was hacked. He had to then confirm that they were, in fact, their emails. He couldn't use the excuse of saying, oh, no, those are not our emails. That's nothing to do with us. That's fake news. That's Russian.
They missed a trick there, didn't they? Yes.
Exactly. But they had no choice.
A little bit too early for that.
Well, they had no choice because they had to anticipate what was going to happen in the court. And by the way, those leaked emails were sent to a BBC reporter months ahead. He sat on them. He didn't do anything about it. So the person who leaked them to him said, okay, I'm going to put them out myself. And guess how he did it? He did it through a Russian internet provider. Why do Russian internet providers get used all the time? Because they're untraceable. And that's part of the whole story that's going on with Hillary Clinton and Trump and the Russian.
Yeah. Well, this leads me to my last question, which is sort of related to what we've been talking about, but I must ask you.
Yeah.
So has there, in your view, actually been this pause in warming, or is it just something that's created by Vladimir Putin?
Vladimir Putin's pretty powerful, but he's not doing that. But the pause seems to have occurred because it appears in the satellite data, inefficient and inadequate as it is, and it also appears in the surface data. And by the way, one of the reasons that they had to stop adjusting the surface data after the year 1998 was because the satellite data had come online. And so now there was an independent source of data that the government didn't control. And the satellite data is controlled by the remote sensing satellite system, RSS, in California, and by the University of Alabama at Huntsville by Spencer and Christie. So you've got independent people running the satellite data, which meant then the bureaucrats at the weather offices controlling the surface data could not do as much adjustment as they'd been doing before. And so you can see that in the record as well. But yes, there's no question. The explanation for the pause, the sun is at over, what, almost 200-year low in sunspot numbers. We know that when the sunspot numbers are low, the Earth is colder. When the sunspot numbers are high, the Earth is warmer. And as I said, we're at a 200-year low. The number of sunspots will continue to decline, and global temperature will continue to decrease. And yet, because of all these lies and deceptions and political manipulation of science, all the world's preparing for warming.
I can't remember where I read it just now. I think it might have been some research institute connected to the London School of Economics. I'm not sure. Anyway, yeah. They said that, you know, maybe it was reasonable to think there might have been a pause back in the day when Phil Jones, I think it was 2010, said that, yes, I think he was asked the question by the BBC, do you think that from 1995 to the present there has been no statistically significant global warming? And he says, yes, but only just. Okay, so that was, they're saying, yeah, it was reasonable back in the day. But now they're saying, if 2005 and 2010 and 2014 and 2015 and 2016 have all been warmer than 1998, then, well, you know, we can't really maintain there's been a pause, can we? Now, this is, you know, judging by our conversation, I think this is going to be a bit of a circular point, but I'm going to ask you, yeah. Does that undercut this pause?
No, it doesn't undercut it, because it's like saying that my increase in height has been the greatest in my last 10 years. Most of your height occurs early in your life, then it levels off, but there's a slight increase. Well, not your age, obviously, but let's say from 20 to 30 or whatever. And that's why I mentioned earlier that 2016, they claimed, was 0.012 warmer than the previous record. Well, what was the previous record? Well, it was in that same period. And so, of course, you're going to find the highest temperatures at the end of an increasing record. Nobody's arguing global temperature hasn't gone up. It's gone up since 1680, and it's due to a natural increase in temperature coming out of the Little Ice Age. So, of course, you're going to find the warmest temperatures now, but it's of no political or scientific significance at all. It's just being used for that political agenda. So, yeah, you can play these games. This is another thing we showed in Australia, where they were saying, oh, it's warmer today than it's been in the Australian record. They say, yeah, because you start your record in 1906. When it was the coldest.
Yeah, that relies on statistics, indeed.
Yeah.
So, I mean, the significance of this pause, then, if indeed, as you say, it has existed and still exists, is that based upon the hypothesis of CO2 being the main cause of global warming, we should have expected there to be no pause and we should have seen a rise continuing, and that's not what we see.
That's right. Go and look at the IPCC forecasts, and they stop calling them forecasts. They call them projections. Even their lowest projection, it's cooler than their lowest projection. In other words, every single projection they've made since they began in 1990 has been wrong, because the actual temperatures are lower than even their lowest projection. And the bottom line of science is, if your forecast is wrong, your science is wrong. End of story. But they still keep putting it out there. According to the IPCC, go back to their 1995 report, the world should be at least almost 1 degree Celsius warmer than it is today. And it isn't. So it's absolutely incredible, the lies they're getting away with.
Well, thank you, Tim, for coming on again. I think we're going to have to draw this to a close now, because we've been talking for so long. Yeah. And we have actually got through all those subjects that I hoped we would. Yeah. And I'm amazed, actually, that you're one of these people who's impossible to put down. I thought I was going to beat you over the head with all these difficult questions today. And you just keep on popping back up. And you're a delight to speak to, as always. And I'm very much looking forward to our next interview, which will be, I think I'll reveal what it's going to be. Or perhaps you should actually say, I mean, I will call it... the impact of geography and climate upon human history. Does that sound okay?
Oh, that's perfect. And by the way, one of the things that we must talk about also is that what has happened, Trump happens to be just the vehicle, but what's happening around the world is that the last phase of the American Revolution had occurred with the Trump election. And that phase was access to information. And we talked about the internet a lot on this program. But the press, the media are finished, as is Hollywood. They just haven't accepted it yet. And
what a wonderful note to end on. Hollywood is finished. Hurrah.
Well, exactly. Wonderful. What the attendance at cinemas is down 70%.
Wouldn't that be wonderful to have a whole load of films coming to the cinema that are not just based upon special effects and propaganda? Wouldn't that be wonderful?
Well, there are more movies being made by Netflix now than by Hollywood. Uh-huh. So Hollywood is shooting itself in the foot. I wanted to find you a quote here, if you can just wait for a second.
Yeah, sure. I can never exhaust all the things you talk about, you know. It's amazing. There's yet another angle pops up.
Okay, I found it here. Okay, one of the things people are going on about the media being in bed with the power elites, they've always been in bed with the power elites. And here is a poem from William Cowper, or Cooper, as the English pronounce it, C-O-W-P-E-R, 1782. Now, think about that historically with the Age of Enlightenment, the American Revolution, the French Revolution is upon us. And this is a poem, 1782. It's called Progress of Error. I'll read it to you. How shall I speak of thee or thy power address, thou God of our idolatry, the press? By thee, religion, liberty, and laws exert their influence and advance their cause. By thee, worse plagues than Pharaoh's land befell, diffused make earth the vestibule of hell. Thou fountain at which drink the good and wise, thou ever-bubbling spring of endless lies. Like Eden's dead probationary tree, knowledge of good and evil is from thee. That's 1782.
That's a wonderful quote.
Isn't it?
What a fantastic way to finish the interview. I'm delighted you brought that up.
Yeah, okay.
So the power of the press and fake news, well, they go back to the dawn of time, do they?
Well, to the dawn of the Age of Enlightenment. And of course, the American Revolution, they got free speech. They got private ownership of land, which made America exceptional. American exceptionalism isn't that they're superior to everybody else. It's just that they've got a constitution that gives individual citizens rights that no other individual citizen in the world has. But the final phase of it was control of information. What Trump did by using tweets bypassed the mainstream media, so it didn't matter what they did. He got elected anyway, and they are absolutely shell-shocked by it. So that's what's happening.
That's a very interesting perspective indeed. Okay, well, thank you ever so much, Tim, for coming on. Wonderful to speak to you, as always. And I look forward to that next time we're talking about the issue described earlier. It'd be great.
Thank you, Julian, and thank you, and good luck with your expanded family.
Thank you.